My name is Ben Stock. As you already mentioned, I'm a PhD student at the University in Erlangen, and what I'm going to present to you today is actually joint work with my colleagues Martin Jons and Sebastian de Kies from SAP Research, who is also shortly affiliated with them. Okay, so just for the agenda, I'm going to give you first a little bit of technical background on how does a web application work, and what the same origin policy actually is. We'll then go into detail on DNS rebinding, present a new attack that we discovered in this paper, and then present our approach on how to extend the same origin policy to actually get rid of DNS rebinding for good. Okay. So Web Application 101, basically in the web we have a client and a server. The client basically is a browser, and it actually interacts with the server such that it sends a request that may contain cookies, for example, and then it gets a reply from the server. The browser then renders the HTML that was provided to him by the server, and this HTML may actually contain active content, so such as JavaScript or Flash or Silverlight or such. And the active content actually enables the web application to interact with the document itself, so using the DOM API, so it can influence the website. For example, Facebook is like, I think, just a small step of HTML and lots of JavaScript building up the website. And it's also enables us, or the web application, to interact with the server, not necessarily the server the content was retrieved from, but using, for example, XML, HTTP requests, or iframes, etc. And all of this is done in the name of the user. So obviously, this is very security sensitive. And sensitive data and the active content may not come from the same source. So basically, if you have an iframe with an advertisement that is actually from a different server, and that iframe should actually not be able to access, for example, the Amazon page that you have just opened. And so access between resources is actually governed by the same origin policy. Okay, what's the same origin policy? I'm basically paraphrasing here from the RFC. The same origin policy restricts access to active content to objects that share the same origin, and the origin hereby is defined by the protocol, the domain, and the port of the entities that are involved. Okay, so how does this look? Basically, this is a standard URL. We have a protocol, which is HTTP, we have a domain name, which is example.org, and we have a port 80. In this case, obviously, this could be omitted because port 80 is the default port for HTTP. And then we have some website web page, so /some/web page, which is actually the path, but the path is not important in regards to the same origin policy. So how does this look in a few examples? Obviously, the resource that is located at the URL shown above is able to access all content that is actually on http://example.org. However, if it then tries to read resources from https://example.org, this obviously is a mismatch in the protocol, so the access is actually denied. Same holds true for a wrong port, so basically same protocol, but port 8080. And quite obviously, example.org cannot just freely read content rendered in the browser from facebook.com. How does the same origin policy actually protect the intranet? So we assume that we have an attacker located at the top that has a web server, and he wants to extract some sensitive data from, say, the local or the corporate wiki that is actually running on 10.0.0.20. Obviously, this is behind a firewall, so he has no idea or he has no way of directly connecting to this. So, but he is able to have to lure a victim or a client that is in the network to his website. So they exchange the connection, and the browser then renders HTML, which contains active content. And now the active content, basically running inside the firewall network, tries to access the resource that is located at 10.0.0.20. Quite obviously, the domain that actually ran the content is attacker.org, and which is now trying to access resources at 10.0.0.20. So quite obviously, we have a mismatch in the domain name, actually. So this is where this same origin policy says no access is not granted to you. Okay. So now I told you about the same origin policy and how it works. DNS rebinding is actually a way around the same origin policy. Let's see a similar example. So we have, a web server of the attacker that and the attacker wants to retrieve data from 10.0.0.20, but also, the attacker is in control of the DNS server that is responsible for attacker.org. We can have our victim that now clicks on a link to example.org. And so what actually happens in the browser is that it first tries to resolve example.org because we need an IP address to connect to the server. So this is the first step, what I omitted in the last slide because it was not important at that point. So the DNS server will then reply with IP address 6.6.6.6, which is the IP address of the attacker's web server on the internet, and set the time to live to, say, 1. So the time to live for a DNS reentry is actually the amount of time the browser or the client may cache the resource until he has to reiterate the lookup. Basically, setting this to 1 means, okay, after 1 second, you have to forget this domain to IP mapping and reiterate the lookup. What we do now is, what the browser now does is connect to the web server, retrieve, again, active content. But now the active content no longer tries to access a resource at 10.0.0.20 directly, but tries to open attacker.org. However, more than 1 second has passed, and thus the DNS entry is no longer valid. And therefore, what the browser actually then does is it reiterates the query and asks the DNS server again, please tell me the IP address of attacker.org. And now in the second step, this IP or this domain is rebound, that's why it's called DNS rebinding, to 10.0.0.20, so the intranet server. And this way, when the active content now tries to access the resource at attacker.org, attacker.org now points to the intranet host. And this way, the same origin policy obviously is fulfilled and access is granted. Okay. So DNS rebinding in some other forms has been around for quite a while. So in 1996, clever students from Princeton actually discovered that there was a way to abuse Java applets, such that, a little bit different than what I explained on the previous slide, when the domain name was resolved, the DNS server actually returned 2 IP addresses. So basically, the first one was the IP address from which the applet was to be loaded, and the second one was the IP address of the target host. And since Java then used the first one to, the first one was used to retrieve the applet, and the second one was then used to connect to the host. So in this case, the same origin policy was fulfilled, and we had kind of DNS rebinding, although it was not rebinding with this rebinding step where we change the domain to IP mapping. As a countermeasure, strict IP-based access control for Java applets was introduced, meaning that Java applets were only allowed to connect to the server's IP address from which this applet was loaded prior to the execution. And this information was actually stored with the Java applet, even in cache. So this effectively stopped this attack of DNS rebinding. This way of DNS rebinding. Then in 2002, there were actually 2 attacks abusing JavaScript. So quickswap DNS is basically what I explained on the slide before the previous one. And the other attack was abusing domain relaxation. Domain relaxation is a way for web applications that run under the same second level domain, but under different subdomains, to interact with each other. And that means they can relax their domain to their parent domain. So basically, evil.attacker.org can say, okay, I want to relax my domain to attacker.org. And what the attack actually did is it set attacker.org to the internal network's IP address, the server's IP address, sorry, whereas evil.attacker.org was mapped to 6.6.6. So the content was then loaded from evil.attacker.org, did domain relaxation, and whoops, we got a DNS rebinding again. So as a countermeasure, the first countermeasure was explicit domain relaxation, meaning that if an application relaxed its domain and tried to access content from another application, then that application also had to explicitly set the document domain property, which it used for domain relaxation. And the countermeasure against the quickswap DNS, or the actual DNS rebinding attack, was DNS pinning, meaning that the browser would ignore the time to live and for each domain store the IP address that was resolved when he first resolved the domain, would store this in cache until this cache was deleted, basically whenever a timeout was reached or more likely whenever the browser was closed. So this actually also helped against DNS rebinding. Then in 2006, my colleague Martin Jones, together with another researcher, discovered a nice way to actually get around this DNS pinning, because basically for failover reasons, what the browser vendors did, they implemented this DNS ping as such that if a connection to this IP address was reset, so basically if the server was no longer there, then it would reiterate the DNS query, and this again led to DNS rebinding. Actually, it worked with multiple plugins, so JavaScript, Flash, Java, even actually allowing socket communication in the browser. So another countermeasure was introduced. Since HTTP 1.1, a client has to send the host header. Actually, the host header is used for running multiple domains on the same server IP address. So the web server actually knows to which domain this request was directed to. And the proposal was to use this host header as a security feature, so to check whether the host presented to the web server actually matched the host of the domain that was, or the list of domains that was allowed for this server. And also networking capabilities for the plugins were severely restricted. So they can only nowadays only connect to a very small set of ports, so they can't actually do that much damage anymore. Ice in there, sorry. So now we discovered a new attack, actually, abusing the HTML5 offline cache. Basically, the idea of abusing the cache is straightforward. So we try to cache a resource that we later want to use. We store it in the cache until this domain to IP mapping is dropped. And then we can actually do DNS rebinding again because the DNS name has to be re-resolved again. However, using the normal browser cache presents a problem here because we don't actually, as an attacker, control the caching behavior. It's based on settings that are done by the client, and all websites share one large cache. And if I, for example, load a lot of sites from Amazon, then all the pictures that are embedded in Amazon will actually fill up the cache and our resource will be gone. So in HTML5, the application cache was, offline application cache was introduced and enables for us as an attacker a controllable cache behavior and thus a way to actually make sure that content is still in the cache when the DNS pinning times have expired. Okay, so what's the HTML5 app cache or HTML5 offline application cache? It's basically used to store parts of an application offline for later use. This is often used in conjunction with bandwidth consumption because we want to, especially if we run a mobile client, for example, we want to make sure that we don't generate that much traffic if it's not necessary. So there was a new attribute added in HTML5 called the manifest attribute. And this is actually a URL attribute pointing to a cache manifest file, and I have a little example on the lower part of the slide. So basically this says, okay, please, dear browser, please cache example.org/index.php and flash SVF, or this could also be some JavaScript. How does it actually work in the browser? So we can have a browser in the server. The browser retrieves the HTML content, parses and sees, okay, there's a manifest attribute, and then retrieves this manifest file from the server. And then caches, stores all the resources that are written down in the manifest file to its cache. And if we actually also cache the index file, so basically the HTML file we got to start with, then if we then open the browser again, or not open it, but visit the website again, sorry, the request is actually delivered not to the network, to the server, but it's actually taken from the cache. And only after the whole site has been loaded and all the content has run, then the manifest file is examined again to see whether it has changed or not. This is due to the fact that it's also called the offline application cache, so we might not even have an internet connection when we run this, so it wouldn't make sense to first catch the manifest. And also for performance reasons, because if I load a website and it's there immediately, then in the background, while I'm using this web application, the cache can be updated. All the time while the application is running. Okay, so how do we abuse this? So we can store resources in the HTML5 app cache. We wait until the victim closes the browser. We load the victim to our attacker website again, now rebound to the internal server's IP address. The victim then retrieves the index file and all the JavaScript from the cache, and we can actually extract the data again and leak it to the attacker. However, in the fifth step, the manifest file is again downloaded from attacker.org/manifest. Basically, we can be very sure that this manifest file will not be there on the internal server, at least not in the form like we had it on our example.org web server or attacker.org web server. So we only have one shot at this. However, there is a nice solution. Most browsers actually allow us to have two domains and do cross-domain caching. So we just use another domain, say attacker1 and attacker2.org. Attacker1.org just has an iframe, framing attacker2.org and says in its manifest file, so attacker1 has a manifest file saying, please cache for me attacker2.org. Now we wait again until the victim has closed the browser, we then do a rebinding step on attacker2.org and can actually extract the information or send the information from this delay frame we have back to the attacker. And after the whole page has run, the manifest file is downloaded, but not from attacker2.org, but from attacker1.org, which is still mapped to our IP address on the internet. So it will still be there, and the resource will remain in the cache. So this is actually a really nice way of doing a persistent attack in DNS rebinding. Okay, so we're back again to history repeating. So we started in 1996, so it's been 17 years. We have the HTML5 offline application attack that actually does not work as well on Internet Explorer, because Internet Explorer is the only browser that does not allow cross-domain caching, but still we have one shot there, so it's still possible. And actually on the plane right over here, I read this paper, which was presented at Woot, FireDrill, and basically their idea is to fill up the DNS cache that exists, so the valid entry will kind of fall out of the cache, and we have to reiterate a DNS query. Nevertheless, we have a countermeasure for both. And we call this the extended same origin policy. Okay, so let's take a step back. What's the same origin policy's duty? The same origin policy's duty is to isolate unrelated web applications from each other based on the origin. And the origin is defined as the protocol, the domain, and the port of the interacting resources. And the semantics of the same origin policy are built around two entities. So we have a web client that actually enforces the policy, so this is the client-side policy, and we have a web server that provides the resources that are subject to this decision of the policy. However, as we just saw within the case of DNS rebinding, actually the entities involved in the decision as such, they are different. So the client is still responsible for enforcing the policy, but the DNS server is actually the one that provides the information that is used for the security decision, because it provides the domain to IP mapping. So what we actually have here is, this is a principal mismatch. So the web server is actually not involved in the whole decision as such. And we aim to fix this problem. And for our idea of the extended same origin policy, we had four design goals in mind. So design goal one, and I'm gonna bash a bit on host header checking here, I'm sorry for that. The design goal one is, it should be a client-side enforcement. So the host header check is a server-side thing, but the same origin policy is a client-side policy, and thus checking of the same origin policy should only be conducted inside the client and not on the server side. It's a protocol layer problem. So we shouldn't try, also, again, bashing the host header, on application level, we should not try to look at the HTTP header that was sent to the server and see, is this host header whitelisted, is it okay? But we should somehow fix this problem on a protocol layer. It should also be a dedicated security functionality. As I was saying previously, the host header actually is not a security functionality, but it's more of a commodity functionality to allow multiple domains on one IP address, or one web server's IP address. And design goal four, and that's very important, it should be non-disruptive. So we don't want to introduce something that is not implemented into each and every application and then would break all the applications. So we need to have a fallback mechanism that the old standard still works. Okay. So the idea is basically we want to extend the same origin policy with some web server provided information and not just DNS server provided information. Only the server should actually be capable of setting its trust boundaries. Right now, what is actually happening is the client tries to figure out this trust boundary using the three entries in the same origin policy. So it's just a guessing game. And we propose, therefore, to extend the same origin policy with server-provided input, so web server-provided input. An easy way to get web server-provided input to the client is actually an HTTP header. And we say, okay, we change this tuple of protocol, domain, and port to add a fourth entry called the server origin. Just one quick word on the extended same origin policy decision logic. So basically, we have an accessing entity and a target entity, and we want to make sure that the old same origin policy is actually still fulfilled. So this is the first criterion we give. And also, we say, okay, the domain of the accessing resource must be contained in the server origin of the target resource. So the server origin can actually be multiple entries, doesn't have to be just one, can be comma separated list. And if the server origin property is not sent, so basically if the application or the web server does not support our approach, then we should just say, okay, the second criterion always evaluates to true and thus fall back to the old same origin policy. As a quick example here, we see, okay, with 10.0020 server origin is 10.0020 and wiki.corp. We rebound attacker.org to this IP address, and the second part of this ESOP decision logic then looks, okay, is attacker.org contained inside 10.0020 and wiki.corp? Obviously it's not, so we drop this. And there are actually many edge cases on multiple domains on the same server as such in the paper, so I refer you to the paper for that. Okay, so let's summarize the extended same origin policy. It's a client-side enforcement, so we meet design goal one, we want to make this on the client, make this check on the client side. An HTTP header is used, so we don't need to change applications, we can do this on the in the server configuration, basically. So this means design goal two. The HTTP header is actually only used for security, so it's not like with the host header where we have a mismatch or we have a header that is actually used for commodity, which is abused kind of for security functionality. And the browsers actually can fall back to the old same origin policy logic if this header is not sent. So we meet design goal four being non-disruptive. We implemented the whole thing in Chromium. It actually consists of just one header extraction. The headers are parsed anyway, so this is actually very cheap, and some string matching. So we didn't notice any overhead at all. Actually, this had to be done in two places. So basically for viewports like iframes and frames and such, and for XML HTTP requests. But nevertheless, I think we changed like 35 lines of code or so. So this was very, very easy. Okay, so as a conclusion, the same origin policy is the most basic security policy there is that is in, exists in the browser. It isolates unrelated web applications from each other based on the origin of the interacting resources, but DNS rebinding actually breaks the current implementation of the same origin policy. And vulnerabilities have been discovered in 1996, 2002, 2006, and now 2013, actually two different vulnerabilities. So this still seems to be a problem after 17 years. So we should actually not try to be a band-aid for the vulnerabilities that have come up, but finish this or fix this for good. It actually is DNS rebinding is a protocol layer flaw because the network, so the DNS server, governs the server's security characteristics because it provides the domain to IP mapping, and therefore we enhance the same origin policy with explicit server origin that is provided by the web server. And actually implemented it in Chromium and had no overhead. And of course, it's an opt-in policy, but if I'm a company and I want to make sure that my resources are protected in the internet, it's very easy for me to just take my servers and configure them such that they provide this server origin, because we only need to do this on the target side. So the target of the attack can actually easily be secured. Okay, so with this, I want to thank you for your attention. And I'm happy to answer any questions. And in case you want to go up my Twitter handle, it's just my name backwards because it wasn't there forwards.
Search? No. Okay. So, interesting work. How would you protect a proxy from manipulating that header to add something in that extended same origin?
Okay. Servers? So basically, it's a bit difficult. I think that's a different attacker model, because it's the attacker model of an active network attacker or somebody who's somewhere in this in the middle. Actually, we used an HTTP header, so we could actually get through proxies. But our attacker model is more: we have an attacker that is sitting on the outside and tries to somehow access resources on the intranet. And this guy is not able to actually do something with proxies because the exchange of the HTTP headers is between the client that is in the intranet and the server that is in the intranet. So usually it won't even access a proxy, I guess.
Right, but I take it that there's no integrity check or anything like that, that client can ensure that header is from the server.
That is true, but as I said, I mean, it's basically to protect against an attacker that comes from the outside and wants to access a resource he can otherwise not access.
Okay.
Hi, this is Antoine Deligna from INRIA Paris. I have a question. I'm wondering, or maybe I'm failing to understand, what is the advantage of your proposed new HTTP header that is set by the server and may or may not be enforced by your client, compared to checking the host header by the server, essentially against the same value that you are proposing to set?
Okay, so basically the reason why we want to do this on the client is because this, the same origin policy, is actually a client-side policy, because it's not, I mean, the service is somehow involved, but nevertheless, it's only something that is checked inside the client, because the client then denies or allows access to a certain restricted resource. So that's why we actually decided not to use the host header, because this is a server-side thing. And also, if you have legacy applications, you might need to change quite a lot of code in this server side, because you need to do the host header checking.
Okay, but I mean, is there any other advantage besides DNS rebinding where your extended policy could be useful?
So actually, what we actually can do, the idea we also had for even further working on the extended SIM origin policy, it allows an application to kind of widen its trust boundaries. Say we have example.org and example.com, and they are basically one website. Now they, because of the same origin policy, those resources of each other cannot directly interact with each other. And using the extended SIM origin policy, we can actually, if of course we then need to remove the original origin, but using this extended SIM origin policy, we are actually able to widen the reach of an application. So,
thank you.
Shuo Chen, Microsoft Research. I think typically in a corporate network, if you have a sensitive website, it is usually require you to authenticate through maybe your domain account. So in that case, I just wonder, is that a secure situation when we consider?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think if you have previously authenticated against your wiki site. So I worked at SAP as well, and we have certificates to authenticate each and every user. So if you want to access the corporate wiki, we open the site once in the browser, and then we ask for the certificate whether we want to send this, and then we are authenticated. So if an attacker is able to abuse an existing browsing session that has previously loaded the corporate wiki.
I think it will be very difficult for the attacker, the outside attacker, to get a valid session in the first place.
That might be the case, but still, I mean, can you be sure? I mean, I guess for really big companies, mm-hmm. this might actually hold true. But nevertheless, there might still be resources. So basically, what our in our paper we presented two attacks. One was using cups. And so the printing service, and you could actually read without any authentication, you could read the error log from cups.
Yeah, okay.
So this might actually, if you're Microsoft and you have cups running somewhere, you don't want to know, want to have people know what kind of documents you printed.
Okay.
So this is actually, so there are some scenarios where actually this might be a problem, even if you have authentication.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Thanks.